On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Being black in America can look pretty sweet these days if you're Dr. Dre, Beyonce, Tiger Woods, Oprah, Barack Obama, and a whole lot more of the big winners in business or culture or sport. But if you're a regular black guy or gal in the world that novelist Michael Thomas paints, it's still a tough road out there. Everything just tilted enough against you to make the world feel all uphill. Thomas's new novel, his first, is Man Gone Down, and it's getting rave reviews. Comparisons to Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, a black narrator, white wife, mixed kids, bills to pay, and a whole lot of trouble right now. Up next, On Point, breakout novelist Michael Thomas and Man Gone Down. Joining me now in the studio is Michael Thomas. He's professor of English at Hunter College in New York and author of the hot new debut novel, Man Gone Down. It's been greeted as ambitious, virtuoso, brilliant, pretty nice right out of the gates. Way to go, Michael Thomas. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What is it like to put a first novel out there and have the hosannas just rain down like this? Cover the New York Times Book Review. Hosanna, Michael Thomas. How's it feel?
I'm still not sure. It's unexpected. I'm still trying to find a way to react to it. It's nice to see my wife smile about it.
I'm sure it is.
It has been somewhat validating for certain friends and former instructors, professors, colleagues.
Not to mention yourself, Michael Thomas. Somewhat validating, I would think.
I'm not sure about that yet. I mean, I keep using this refrain. It's strange. It's strange.
We'll take that as a writer's reasonable starting point. You know, we talk with lots of writers here, but you're a brand new one, and people won't necessarily, well, they don't know anything about you yet, and may well not have touched the book yet. If you'd be generous enough, frame the story. Tell us the outline of the story.
The outline is a man, 35 years old. He lives in Brooklyn. He's just lost a lease on an apartment. He's had to ship his wife and three kids away to his mother-in-law's house in coastal Massachusetts while he looks for a job and looks for a place to live, albeit there's a ironic severing of ambition and desire, I would say. He doesn't feel really equipped to do any of these things. He's crashing on the bed of a friend's child, a six-year-old boy, mm-hmm. Who's away in the Hamptons for the summer. So he's with his friend/acquaintance who's an intellectual properties lawyer and who makes
zillions.
And so he's staying in this kind of renovated Brooklyn brownstone, sleeping on a bed that's too short for him. He's about 6'4", and just in a very Hamlet-like way, looking at things and watching them spin. When what he needs to do is come up with about $12,000 by Friday, the narrative begins.
He's got
Monday.
4 days. He's it really takes days. Place in a jam-packed, desperate little bit of time.
Yeah, it's quite a week. Yeah.
Now that is interesting because you've told us the whole story there, but you've told it with no reference to color, and yet color runs all through this book. Paint in the black and white here. Bring in the color.
Well, he is phenotypically black.
Phenotypically.
Yeah, he is identified by outsiders as being black or brown or whatever you'd want to call
as
it.
As we do in this culture with certain traits. And
as we
go.
Certainly do. His mother is a black Irish Indian. Mm-hmm. She's certainly mixed, as his father is too, but of course they're phenotypically black. And he is in a upper middle class gentrified neighborhood in Brooklyn, dealing with private schools and wealthy, not even peers, because they're not peers.
Because he's not really at their financial economic level.
He's not at
he's sort of passing or trying to.
Yeah, they're white. They're professional. He is a part-time carpenter, an adjunct instructor, kind of a drifter. He's indigent to a certain extent.
Identified by them as black, by the world as black in this book.
Identified by them as black, not that they know what that means, but certainly. Right.
I mean, as Al Sharpton knows and everybody knows, there's a lot of everything behind that word black.
There's a lot of everything, but no one, not too many people care to examine. And certainly the characters he runs into don't really examine what that is. And so he's somewhat isolated in his community, and he is he's married to a white woman. I think he refers to her as his Brahmin princess.
Why is that? Why is he married to a white woman? You had any choice in the world?
Well, he fell in love with her. He saw her one day, and he recognized her as not being the girl. You know, certainly not the one he envisioned for himself, if there was going to be any. But there's something about her that he felt compelled to, and went with it.
But still, it's a choice, or maybe not. So much of this book is practically autobiographical. You were raised in Boston, now live in Brooklyn. He was the same.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's all over the reviews of the book. You've got him married to a white woman. You the same. Kids by that woman. You the same. So maybe you didn't have a choice. Did he fall in love with her or you fell in love with her?
Well, you know, that's where autobiography and fiction diverge. And, you know, I am married to a white woman. I don't think I've referred to her as a Brahmin princess. and his perspective of her and her world is far different from my own, of my wife and where she comes from and how she relates to me, my children, my family, and my upbringing.
I guess what I'm getting at is you did have a choice there.
Sure.
I mean, and so, you know, what is it that you're looking to point up? I mean, this is just one point, but what is it you're looking to point up with that particular pairing?
Well, he falls in love. He is raised. He's certainly born in the summer of love, or the generation of love, the end of the civil rights movement. He is an inheritor of that movement, of the Beatitudes, right? The Sermon of the Mount on the Mount, and love, right? And I think the epigraph starting
Martin
the book
Luther King and all the rest.
We proclaim love our salvation, Marvin Gaye, and so the question asks: if you do fall in love, or if you do love something, then what is the choice and what is the question? And it gets back into, I think...
And if love is first, color second.
Yeah, or gender, or socioeconomic strata, or whatever demographic you want to throw out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, love first. And do we make that choice of love first?
Mm.
Or do we make other choices? You know, do we arrange our love? Do we fudge our love? Or do we fudge who and what we love or stand behind? You know, are we that Kierkegaardian knight of resignation or the knight of faith?
Mm-hmm.
And if we choose faith as opposed to a life of convenience, you know, I guess as Thoreau would say, right?
Mm.
If we choose convenience over inconvenience, if we choose demographics over love, if we choose... some kind of agenda, personal agenda that has very little to do with faith or love, then, you know, where are we headed? And I think, you know, the microcosm, it talks about people's individual choices.
Let me ask you a big, broad question. There's so much I want to ask about here. But we live in a time when it comes to, let's say, African Americans, blacks, it can be seen in so many ways. In the media, we're always seeing examples of very successful, very wealthy, glossy, you know, whether it's Oprah or Venus and Serena just ludicrous, you name it, P. Diddy, Barack Obama, Oprah, go right on down, there's a big list. And yet, in this book, you're presenting this black man as beset by bedeviling circumstances related to color that trip him up and frustrate him and leave him angry and ill-equipped and you describe it. But so are you looking at the reality? Are we looking at an illusion? Is this a good time to be black, a bad time to be black? Take us in there.
Well, I think it's always been a good and bad time to be black or be human. You know, Du Bois pointed to the 20th century as being, you know, the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line and the but not a question of black or white. He points to the black American as a microcosm for humanity, right? That struggle within, you know, the two warring souls.
Mm-hmm.
But I would posit that anyone has at least two warring souls.
So it's a level playing field then? But you don't seem to suggest that.
Well, of course
that.
Not. It's not a level playing field. And if you want to point to Obama, or if you want to point to Oprah, if you want to point to Shaquille O'Neal or mm-hmm. whomever, entertainers, you know, I'm not 7'2" and I don't weigh 350 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you want to look at it in those regards, what we see is a representation of, well, how many black senators are there?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And how many black Fortune 400 or 500 people are there? How many affluent black people are there? And it's easy to point at entertainment and sports or athletics and say, look at these people, but they make up such a tiny percentage of the American population.
A lot of comparisons here, references in the reviews and very glowing reviews of this book to Ralph Ellison's 1952 Invisible Man. That book changed the way Americans thought about race. It changed American literature. It was an unprecedented, intimate journey into bigotry, racism. I want to play here the famous opening passage of that book, Invisible Man, by the great Ralph Ellison, where the spiritually wounded narrator talks about what it's like to be black in America, read here by actor Joe Morton.
I am an invisible man. No, I am not a spook like those who haunted Edgar Allan Poe, nor am I one of your Hollywood movie ectoplasms. I am a man of substance, of flesh and bone, fiber and liquids, and I might even be said to possess a mind. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me, like the bodiless heads you see sometimes in circus sideshows. It is as though I have been surrounded by mirrors of hard, distorting glass.
There, the opening lines of Ralph Ellison's 1952 Invisible Man. With me now, Michael Thomas, author of the debut novel Man Gone Down. And Michael Thomas, what about it, The Invisible Man, then, 1952? Where have we come? We're sitting here now. Same? Does this resonate just loud, clear, and present for you, or is there a difference?
Oh, yeah, it resonates very clearly, very loud. I think, you know, what Ellison is speaking to, or certainly his narrator, is about projection, right?
Mm.
Projections hurled at people, announced, you are this, you are that. And, Ellison quotes both Melville and Eliot at the beginning of the novel from a family reunion. Eliot, you know, it's not me you're looking at. I'm paraphrasing. I'm not directly
mm-hmm.
quoting,
mm-hmm.
right? It's something else. Let your necrophily feed on that carcass.
Ooh.
You know, over there.
Ooh.
You're looking at something over there, but you're
mm-hmm.
not seeing me. You're
mm-hmm.
seeing.
Don't lock me up in that carcass.
Well, and of course, Eliot points to it in many different pieces, but certainly in Proof Rock, you know, when I am
mm-hmm.
pinned and wriggling on a wall,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have got me labeled like some kind of insect, you know, with the Latinate name underneath, then you would have known me, or you would have figured me out, or you would have understood my history or my trajectory into the future.
But didn't T.S. Eliot, for that matter, didn't Ralph Ellison live in a different time? 1952, with Ellison, Invisible Man. Haven't we come somewhere since then?
I think, yeah.
If you're the update, what's the news in the interim?
What's the news over the last 50-odd years? I don't know. I still have people walking up to me and announcing things about who I am and what I am and where I go and what I will be and where I've been.
What do you mean by that? How does that work?
Well, they're because of how I look.
Young, black, handsome, sort of light-skinned, Rasta curls. So these are descriptors. So what? Do they still mean what they might have?
I don't know if they mean what they might have 50 years ago, but they do mean something. I'm not that young.
Okay.
Look
young. Good for you.
Yeah, I'm not that young. I'm dealing with that right now.
39.
Yeah. I mean, it's something as mundane as the assumption that because I have dreadlocks that I'm from somewhere, or that I should sound like something,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, as minute as if I crack a joke like John Cleese, I get a very strange look. But if my dear friend who's white cranks the same joke,
mm-hmm.
And
it's like, why are you cracking John Cleese jokes?
Yeah, I'm not allowed to
right.
like Elliot or teach mm-hmm. Elliot. I teach Elliot. Mm-hmm. I have, of course, the four quartets, and I walk in mm-hmm. the classroom, and people look at me as though...
Where's the tweed coat?
Where is the tweed coat?
You know, the white
where
skin.
Where's the gray hair? Where's the white skin? Why, you know, why are you the keeper of this trembling Anglicans.
and in 2007, can you still not, as a, and here's the, you know, the phenotype, the black man, can you still not stride past that, brush by that, and say, oh, forget that.
Let's go. I can.
But I mean, but you've got your narrator, and again, this is close, very close to autobiography here at many points, it's kind of, you know, just fulminating over it again and again. He might inform stride past it, but inside he's not striding past it at all. It's flypaper.
Well, if I were to have written a memoir, I would have yeah. read very differently. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. there are autobiographical underpinnings, certainly, and perhaps even moments, but it's certainly through a different lens.
I don't mean to make too much of the autobiography there, but just that your man is stuck on that.
My man is stuck on it. And my man is a study, and my man is a character in fiction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, perhaps I've been luckier than my man. Perhaps I'm not as aware as my man, or mm-hmm. perhaps I don't carry the same chip that my character carries on his shoulder, which I think some people have commented on, that he has an enormous chip. And he is quite brooding, mm-hmm. and he is quite sullen at times. But he is stuck, and he is constantly wrangling with the question of who defines self. And if it's the world outside that defines self, which mm-hmm. other people seem to be okay with.
Mm-hmm. We do it all the time.
Then what does he do?
Because he's... stuck by that?
He's stuck by that because he can't seem to morph himself into any of those definitions. And I think if he could, I think he would be all right. But he's tried, perhaps, you know, not faithfully, but has attempted to be the thing that he's supposed to be. And now the question is, if he's supposed to define self, one of his concerns is, I'm too damaged, is one of the refrains he has. He doesn't quite know how to define self. Mm.
And damaged by history.
Damaged by history, damaged by self, damaged by self-perception, damaged by outside perception, damaged by physical encounters, damaged by
and color running all through that. We've heard Ralph Ellison. Mm-hmm. Let's hear some Michael Thomas. There's a piece, page 77 or so, that begins to speak to this. Could you read it? This is Michael Thomas reading from his new novel debut, much celebrated Man Gone Down.
It's a strange thing to go through life as a social experiment, bust, tested, and bust elsewhere, groomed for leadership. When I was a boy, my room was full of great men's images, posters on one wall of Gandhi, King, Jackie Robinson, Malcolm X, Tommy Smith, and John Carlos, Stokely Carmichael, a pen and ink drawing of Frederick Douglass, the Jackson Five, Crazy Horse, a W.E.B. Du Bois bank, and a Booker T. Washington mural. And on another wall, the 67 Red Sox, Ted Williams, a Shakespeare collage, a family tree of the Greek deities, Oscar the Grouch, Bill Russell. And I remember trying to understand the segregation of the images. The best I could come up with was that one wall was my mother's and the other was my father's. But even then, it was difficult to keep straight. Each individual image reflected and rejected the alleged virtues of each group and person. That room, those walls, gone, cash from a second mortgage invested in somebody's business venture. In the summer of 72, my father had either been laid off or fired. My mother went to work, so he had to take care of me. In the mid-mornings, he'd call up the stairs for me to wake. She would have already tried and failed, first by moving things around the room roughly and noisily. Then she'd leave, and I'd hear the tub running. She'd come back when she was done. I'd open my eyes a crack. She'd be wrapped in a towel, hair in rollers and scarf, hissing, "Get up!" She would leave again, dress, re-enter, and rip my covers off with an inscrutable hiss, standing there with my blankets, the freckled Celtic black Indian, red-armed, yellow-faced, eagle-nosed, one eye amber and one eye green, the progeny of, to name only a few, an Irish boat caulker, Cherokee drifter, and quadroon slave. Get up! And then she would go, and I'd drift off until my father ascended the stairs with his stinky instant coffee breath, nudged me, and whispered my name.
Michael Thomas, reading there from his debut novel, Man Gone Down. Michael Thomas, a lot of listeners would like to talk to you. I want to begin to invite them in. From Jacksonville, Florida, Ken is calling. Hi, Ken. You're on the air with Michael Thomas.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Michael. How are you guys?
Great. Thanks.
Michael, I'm about 100 pages into your novel, and I'm really liking it. And, your story, my wife and I just laugh how it describes us. I'm 31, I'm black, she's white, three kids, same age as CX and a baby.
Uh-oh, you're right in the middle of it.
It's really funny. I have two questions for you. The first question is about your novel specifically. You go back and forth from the past to the present pretty consistently and sometimes without warning. And the question I have, I understand what you're doing is trying to set up and get us a little insight of who this guy is and why this guy is the way he is when it comes to race and him running down the street and seeing white people, things of that nature. But my question to you would be, why couldn't we get that story all together?
You want it linear. You want it to march through chronologically.
Yeah, exactly.
Getting dizzy.
That way, because I can appreciate the character and understand why he's going through that instead of getting to me bits and pieces.
Okay, Professor of English Michael Thomas, there's your reader.
Okay. Well, the architecture of the book, and getting back to Ellison and Dostoevsky, it's a mind under pressure, and it's a man walking through his life. And
4 days in New York, and they're rough.
4 days in New York, and it's a solipsistic, it's been called, very close narrative. It's interiority, and I wanted to work with how memory comes about.
Mm-hmm.
As an example, I was driving into Boston. I'm from Boston with my
mm-hmm.
son,
mm-hmm.
My oldest child, and we're driving down the Mass Turnpike, and we looked up at the Sheraton in Newton Corner.
Sure.
And I'd always wanted to stay at the Sheraton as a boy, and the Red Coach Grill, and
you went to school out the way. Your mom snuck you into the public schools.
Yes,
in
she
that
did.
Neck of the woods.
And
mm-hmm.
so, we drove under the Star Market in Newtonville, which is now a Shaw's. And mm-hmm. I had this pang of kind of horror and dread. And a memory flashed of, my brother working there or walking past on a snowy day. And, maybe seeing a girl I had a crush on and avoiding her by sneaking behind a mailbox or something like that.
And chronology was disrupted. You were in the past.
I was in the past and a fragmented past. And then coming to look at my son, who is approaching that girl crushy age, not mm-hmm. that he has one, but mm-hmm. he's approaching sure. it and looking at him and projecting things on him. So my narrative influencing the way I regard or was regarding that the now. You know?
And maybe his future as well. And there it is all in that instant. Ken, are you on board?
I'm very satisfied with that. It reminds me of William Faulkner's Song of the Fury, with the mentally handicapped person keep going back and forth. My second question, as a professor of literature, what do you think about today's array of black authors who, for the majority of them, I would say 89% of them, write more about sex and relationships as opposed to what you're writing about when it comes to race, but not necessarily just writing about race, but just writing about something more of a substance as opposed to just sex and sex and sex? What do you think about that as a professor of literature and now a writer?
Oh, that's a pretty loaded question. I think I can make some enemies there. So, not everyone writes about it. Edward Jones wrote a fine novel, and has a couple of fine collections of short
mm-hmm.
stories. Martha Southgate has a few fine novels out there. I'm not sure if it's different. It's pop culture, and it's what the market demands. And I think the considerations have always been, are we going to, write literary things? Are we going to make fine art, or are we going to make consumables?
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't know what to say to them. I mean, the reason why I write the way I do is because, I couldn't ask a girl on a date. And there aren't any sex scenes in my book, or there are very few, or they're kind of troubled.
Yeah.
So I couldn't make a mandate to black writers what they should or shouldn't write about. I think the literary fiction world is very difficult to crack into. And there are caveats out there against young writers to even begin to tackle large themes.
Or hard to blame someone trying to make a living.
It's hard to blame somebody trying to make a living, yeah.
It can, you know, before we let you go from Jacksonville, I mean, you laid it out, the ways in which your mixed marriage and kids and the rest are sort of in simple terms like the story Michael Thomas describes. What about the anger his protagonist is feeling here in that what we call black skin, in that marriage and its peculiarities in this society now? Do you relate to that part of the book?
I keep it hidden, just like his protagonist does.
You keep it hidden, you say.
Mm-hmm. There are many situations when we are having people over at our house, or we're out to dinner with people, or we're out with things, and most times I'm surrounded by white people. Very few times am I surrounded by black people, unless it's, you know, my friends outside of work and family that I have. So, I mean, there are many times where people say things that they're not understanding exactly what they're saying, do things that they're not exactly sure what they're doing. I mean, they look at my kids, and of course, they always say my kids are so beautiful and so great and things like that. And of course, we love those accolades, but it gets to a point where, are they really saying my kids are beautiful, or are they really saying my kids are different?
Are you carrying a ball of anger about that, or is that just the way it is?
Well, kind of like Michael Thomas says, you know, you get to just kind of roll over it. You internalize it, and you brush it off because you have to continue to live your life and try to strive to be what you're trying to be. However, I mean, yes, I get it every day. I mean, me being in middle class and living where I live, I live in one of the better areas of Jacksonville, and my son is he's in kindergarten, my oldest, and he's the only black kid, you know, out of in his class, and maybe in the kindergarten class, and it's just one of those things, and you just kind of deal with it because I'm trying to give my kids something I didn't have when it comes to better education and things of that nature. So,
Ken, Michael Thomas is closing his eyes and sort of visualizing just your circumstances, I'm betting. I appreciate your call from Jacksonville. Michael, is this a conversation? Here's the white guy question, but I mean, is this a conversation we've just had with Ken? Do black guys have this conversation? Is it something, you know, or is it just like understood?
Do black guys have this conversation?
The conversation about a presence of race and color issues in their lives all the time, or is it you just suck it up, deal with it? It's your private issue matter.
Oh, well, I think, you know, like as Ken was saying, you know, I've certainly experienced moments like that where you're in a situation that is supposed to be familiar, but you are thoroughly alien.
We're talking this hour with breakout writer Michael Thomas. His new novel, celebrated debut, is Man Gone Down, about a black man still struggling in a white world. A lot of references in the book as well to A Raisin in the Sun, famous stage play. In the 1961 film of A Raisin in the Sun, Walter Younger, played by Sidney Poitier, boils with racial frustration. The play by Lorraine Hansberry, on which the movie's based, is a recurring touchstone in Michael Thomas's new novel. Let's listen here to a scene from the film. Poitier's character tries to explain to his mother the limitations on his life because of his color.
Mama, I want so many things. Oh. I mean, I want so many things that sometimes I think they're going to drive me crazy. Mm. See, I'm 35 years old, and I ain't got nothing. I ain't going to be nothing, Mama. Just look at me. Look at me.
I'm looking at you, and you're a good-looking boy. You got a job, a fine wife, a son,
yes. A job? Now, I open and close car doors all day. I drive a man around in his limousine, and I say, yes, sir. And no, sir. And shall I take the drive, sir? Mama, that ain't no kind of a job. That ain't nothing at all.
Sidney Poitier right there, 1961, A Raisin in the Sun, the film version. Foe is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Foe, you're on the air with Michael Thomas.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Michael. How are you?
Hi, well, thank you.
I'm well, thanks.
Good. Listen, I just finished your book, and I wanted to let you know I appreciated the interior life that you revealed about the character and the complexity you brought to it. And I'm reading the book, and I'm like, okay, how is he going to resolve this? How is he going to deal with this dilemma of this family and the situation? And I got to the end, and when I got to the end, I thought, and without spoiling it for anybody, I thought, is this book more a love story than I realized when I got there? Can you respond to that?
More a love story than what? May I ask you that first of all?
Then I realized. I mean, I thought more of the character was involved with his situation and trying to resolve all the issues that he had with taking care of his family, getting a job, getting a place to live. And then I got to the end, Michael, and I thought the way that you resolved it, there was more a of a love story in this book that maybe I didn't realize that was a part of it, too. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, sure. Without giving away the ending, you know, the surprise mystery mm-hmm. ending, there is a love story running through it, and has to do with certainly the narrator and his wife, and certainly the narrator and his children, and perhaps even the narrator and himself. And getting back to what Ken from Jacksonville mm-hmm. was talking about, mm-hmm. if I may, mm-hmm. he was talking about being in certain social situations and perhaps feeling alienated and in a place that you should feel included. And I think
with your wife on a night out, though he said often maybe the only black guy, man, person.
Sure. And perhaps we all have a sneaking suspicion that we're somewhat alienated from others, mm-hmm. even self. Mm-hmm. And I guess the things that I've shared with Ken is having that confirmed at times, at the most unexpected times, and there is a kind of hurt and rage that comes from that. But of course, there is the questioning, and I think getting back to what you said earlier, this narrator, he doesn't want to be defined by the world outside of him, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he is the authority to define self, because he mm-hmm. questions self. You mm-hmm. know, why have that privilege? But getting back to the love story aspect, yeah, he's full of longing, and he wants to love and be loved, and he certainly has been taught that love is the salvation, right? Mm-hmm. We proclaim love our salvation. Mm-hmm. We begin there and we mm-hmm. end there. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't live in a world without love. I mean, I can quote so many different mm-hmm. things. Yeah. But
it's across a color line in this case that love story. And you write, there's one, if I may pick up here, there's a phrase you use in this book, which I cannot imagine on the page of a white writer in 2007. You have him thinking about what he calls, again, this black man, white wife. He writes about the wreckage of miscegenation. How does that fit in a love story where part of the love is for his wife and part for his kids? The wreckage of miscegenation. What's that about?
Well, a grace note, you know. Love, and what would you do for love? And I think he's looking at his wife, and he thinks about his kids or his potential kids, and a great amount of this has to do with backstory. What is the wreckage of miscegenation? Well, I mean, part of it's tongue-in-cheek, because mm-hmm. he does poke fun at himself. He is sullen, and he is brooding, but he has a pretty dark sense of humor.
But it's a mixed race marriage and mixed race children whom he loves. Wreckage?
Well, considering his arc and considering the arcs he can imagine for them, where else is it going to wind up?
What about this thought then? And thank you for your call and bringing the love story up. You know, I happened to be flipping through Vibe magazine yesterday, mm-hmm. and of course it's kind of a very classy magazine with kind of black target audience. You know, the pages are full of these beautiful mixed race children, which sort of look in this case luxurious ad settings. There's Sean Jean clothes, but they look like the sort of victorious face of a new century. This looks like the American face in the new century. You talk about wreckage of miscegenation, but isn't there a kind of popular perception that mixed race is where it's at, where it's going, what's hot, what's happening?
Yeah, well, I guess Eliot would say in the popular mind, yeah. It's where it's going. 150 years ago, you know, one drop of blood. So there
isn't the popular mind in the end kind of what matters, the big glacier that moves slowly but is the mind?
Well, I'm not sure if you can equate the popular mind to the glacier. The glacier, without any challenge, will just mow things over and change the face of the world. The popular mind, or perhaps pop culture, or the advertisements in magazines of medium or light-skinned people as beautiful. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what that is.
A new ideal?
A new ideal of inclusion. I think to be irresponsible with imagery is to point to a misunderstanding or lack of understanding of the content underneath it.
Is it irresponsible for Vibe magazine to publish advertisements that show beautifully clad mixed race kids living the fine life?
I have no idea. I mean, that's probably why I'd be a failed, you know, ad executive or any kind of businessman.
Well, then read about the kids described in the book directly, if you would. There's a bit early in the book where where the protagonist is sort of looking down on his children.
Okay.
He calls them, and we should point this out, X and C.
X looks exactly like me, not me at 3 years old, me as a man. He has a man's body and a man's head, square-jawed, no fat or softness. He has everything except the stubble, scars, and age lines. X looks exactly like me, except he's white. He has bright blue-gray eyes that at times fade to green. They're the only part of him that at times looks young, wild, and unfocused, looking at you but spinning everywhere. In the summer, he's blonde and bronze, colored. He looks like a tan elf on steroids. It would seem fitting to tie a sword to his waist and strap a shield on his back. X could pass. It was too soon to tell about his sister, but it was obvious that C could not. I sometimes see the arcs of each boy's life based solely on the reactions from strangers, friends, and family, the reactions to their colors. They've already assigned my boys qualities. C is quiet and moody. X is eccentric. X, who from the age of 2 has believed he is a carnivorous dinosaur, who leaps, claws, and bites, who speaks to no one outside his immediate family, who regards interlopers with a cool reptilian smirk, is charming. His blue eyes somehow signify a grace and virtue and respect that needn't be earned. Privilege. Something that his brother will never possess, even if he puts down the paintbrush, the soccer ball, and smiles at people in the same impish way. But they are my boys. They both call me Daddy in the same soft way. C with his husky snarl, X with his baby lisp. What will it take to make them not brothers?
Michael Thomas, reading from Man Gone Down. Let's go to Orangeburg, South Carolina, and Kevin. Hi, Kevin, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Very well, thank you.
I'm in the middle of a few things, but I wanted to call in, and I want to say that though I haven't read the gentleman's book, I just have my own personal opinions. I'm a father of five, and you know, I've been married for over 10 years, and I just have an opinion about a lot of the things that's going on right now that I would just like to share. Many may not fully understand it, but, you know, I'm an African-American, and I just want to say that the issue of overcoming racism in this country is not really the, or shouldn't be made, the responsibility of those people who were brought here and have had to endure the prejudice, the racism, the bigotry. I know some people would say, I heard somebody in Virginia one day on TV during the news, I was watching one evening, about black people should just get over it. Mm. Well, it's true, we should, but it's not as easy as said. However, I think that in saying that, gives white people a free pass to excuse themselves for what ultimately they were responsible for.
Does it, whatever it is, the color issue, does it still hit you in the face every day, Kevin?
No, it doesn't hit me in the face because I'm the type of person that I don't allow it. I don't give that a chance. I'm an assertive person. I don't lower my expectations of myself, my standards for anyone. I believe I know who I am, and I chart where I plan to go and how I plan to get there.
Do you think your five children in this century, where we stand now, looking forward, face a different picture when it comes to color and expectations?
I'm glad you asked that, because just not too long ago, my 6-year-old daughter asked, you know, me a question concerning a social studies homework assignment she needed some help with, and it had, and because of it being Black History Month, it had to do with, you know, come here, I'm talking to my son.
Sure.
Why did we have to do that, she asked. You know, something in her mind, you know, was standing out, I guess, the way we do things at home, as to why did there have to be, you know, a period for when one people had to fight for rights that should be a right for every human being.
But does that mean she's more free of that or not?
I think that I don't exactly understand what you mean when you say she's more free of that. I think this is how I would sum up when she asked me that question. I think that she is coming into the realization that we don't live in a world where, you know, in kindergarten and in first grade and everything, children see children as children. She's beginning to understand that there are differences between her and others. And what is important to me as a parent is for her to understand that no matter what the obstacles there are that one is faced with, you call it as you see it and you act upon it. And you just do the right things. That is what I think is what's most important for us as a people to have to try to start doing. Yes, we need to get past it, but at the same time, it's only right and it's only fair, though we shouldn't seek it, but there are still too many of us who do, seek the approval, you know, from those who ultimately, when you look at the history of America,
yep,
responsible for the racism and the prejudice and the bigotry, and it's because of white people not wanting to acknowledge that you know, generations of today, really the script should be flipped.
Kevin, you say it so clearly, and I want to get to a couple more callers, but we appreciate yours from Orangeburg. Thank you very much for being there. Let me go to Laura. You really lay out a lot for us right there, and Michael Thomas is sort of nodding along. Laurie is calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Laurie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Michael. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to tell Michael that this is the book I'm recommending to everybody I know. I pulled it off of a library shelf, didn't know anything about it about a month ago, and read through it over a weekend, and I was incredibly moved
by
it. Why? Well, I thought it was both challenging, and it made me uneasy.
Are you white? What did you learn about race, if you are?
I'm a white woman living in the suburbs. I could relate to the last caller because my son's in the backseat of the car wondering when we're going to get some snacks, and this was a book that I felt was, you know, for lack of a genderless term, to say something like, it's an everyman book. And I thought it really spoke to so many different issues. And
whether you're black or white, you mean sort of just facing life as it charges at you.
Exactly. I mean, it was a completely human novel. And that's not to laud the race mm-hmm. issues in it. I learned a great deal about it. There were parts of my own ideas about race that made me uncomfortable reading the book. But I just felt like it was such a challenge, and I'm so not often challenged by contemporary literature.
Mm. Laurie, our time grows so short, and to Michael and Georgia and everybody else, I'm sorry we can't get to you, but Michael Thomas, there's a big thumbs up from a white suburban reader who says, you know, it's her number one.
Well, thank you, Laurie. A couple of things I wanted to speak about. And mm-hmm. getting back to that the ad in Vibe.
Yeah.
And what Kevin was speaking about in very large terms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, and neither does my character. I think this is where perhaps we merge philosophically. How can you solve something like race, right, or talk about race in the marketplace? Right, the marketplace.
Everything else is out there in this country.
Well, the marketplace simplifies, right?
Of course.
And it's not a simple question. You can't just put out some light-skinned people in a car with. And I'm not saying that this is the motivation or the motive behind the advertisement, but I think, as you know, globalization, we can solve it with capitalism. If we just throw money at it, it will work. But of course, you know, I was just watching, I think it was Antoine Fuqua's documentary, Bastards of the Party, the other night. Mm-hmm. And a fantastic documentary about the Crips and the Bloods and the Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how many jails have been built in California in the last 15 years?
A whole lot.
There is this kind of a superficial glossing of not just race, but, you know, you could say, you know, Iraq, or you could say Afghanistan, or you could say you could say whatever. You could say, you know, gay rights. You could say women's rights. There's this glossing. You know, it's like Disney making Hercules, right? Mm. You know, and then everything was, you know, Hercules killed his children and went mad. You know,
Michael Thomas, you are a long way from being stuck in the gloss, and we appreciate that. We got to do another hour sometime. We could just go on and on. The new book is Man Gone Down. It's terrific. We're very grateful to you for being with us this hour. Good luck with everything.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Marvin Gaye takes us out. Michael Thomas's new book, Man Gone Down. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.